Welcome back to Health Bite, the podcast for small, actionable bites towards healthy living. Your relationship with food is a window into your relationship with yourself. And in this podcast, we will explore how to redefine this relationship so you can not only achieve your weight loss goals, but also greater mental, emotional, and physical well-being. I'm your host, Dr. Adrienne Udeem, and if you love what you hear on this podcast, head over to wherever you listen, rate this episode, and leave a review. So it's that time of month, the time of month when we recap some of the food, nutrition, and weight loss topics in the news. And first up is CoolSculpting. CoolSculpting made it into the news this week in a big way. So I want to start with a story, my own CoolSculpting story, which many years ago, I was training for the LA Marathon, trying to get myself to the 26 plus miles that I'd have to run. I was training by running up to 60 miles per week, and I was by far the leanest I have been and the leanest I likely will ever be in all of my life. But alas, there is vanity. And sometimes the more that we do, the harder we try, the more self-critical we become. I had zoned into the fat that I had clinging to my inner thighs, an area that no amount of exercise was going to address. In comes CoolSculpting. Wow, I remember thinking, there is a contraption that can suck, freeze, and get rid of fat without surgery. I was in. And a couple sessions later, I learned that, of course, nothing is quite what it seems and that nothing comes without a cost. True, that area looked a little less full, but now it looked kind of weird. If I squinted, I could make out the lines of the applicator. And to be honest, I was not happy about it. I later learned that this appearance was called the shark bite and was something that was known in the industry and not terribly uncommon with CoolSculpting. Basically, the fat in the area was diminished, but it was very clearly demarcated in a way that was not aesthetically pleasing. Well, this week we learned that indeed, nothing is quite what it seems, and indeed, nothing comes without a cost. And that CoolSculpt can have some very unwanted side effects. So first, let's define it. Let's talk about what is CoolSculpting. And the technical term for this procedure is called cryolipolysis. And basically, it involves using a device or an applicator that is applied to the area of the body with excess fat. This applicator will then basically suck in that fatty tissue and deliver to it very cold temperatures, negative 11 degrees Celsius to be exact, to freeze the fat cells in the targeted area of body. Typically, it requires multiple treatments to the same area. And the goal again is to freeze the fat cells to the point that they don't survive. Fat cells will then implode, die, and get absorbed by the body. Sounds pretty easy, right? But of course, there are side effects. And CoolSculpting can result in several known side effects like hyperpigmentation or darkening of that area, pain in the area, frostbite, yikes. But the one that has come into spotlight this past week is quite alarming and disfiguring, and it's called paradoxical adipose hyperplasia. Paradoxical because it's something that is the opposite of what we expect to happen. Adipose, which is another term for fatty tissue, and hyperplasia, which means growth. So this is a complication which results in a paradoxical growth of the fatty tissue. Obviously, not something that is wanted when the goal is to reduce or minimize fatty tissue in that area. This complication can appear as late as 6 months after the procedure, and it's seen as this visibly hardened area of fat that most often requires surgery to correct. This complication came to light this past week as supermodel Linda Evangelista filed a lawsuit against Zeltique Aesthetics. And she says, "It increased, not decreased, my fat cells and left me permanently deformed." There are now multiple reports of people coming out talking about the PAH or paradoxical adipose hyperplasia and how they had hard fatty tissue that was basically lodged in the body. In some circumstances, people reported that this hardened tissue migrated to other areas and required one, if not multiple surgical procedures or surgeries to correct. What makes this situation even more complicated is that this frequency of PAH seems to be greater than once reported. In a study that was published in this aesthetic surgery journal this past July, they reported the frequency to be as frequent as one in every 2,000 treatments, as compared to the initial study in 2014 that reported the incidence as one in every 20,000 patients. Now, that's quite a difference in numbers. And notice that in the more recent report, they are stating it in terms of treatments, whereas the initial study or report was in terms of patients. Now, that may have not been an accident, and the company is now being criticized for misrepresenting the truth of this problematic complication. Because remember, I told you that each patient is recommended to get multiple treatments. And so if we discuss this complication in terms of patients, of course, it's going to appear much less than if we report this complication in terms of treatments. And so one in 2,000 treatments is quite different than one in 20,000. And so slap on the hand to the company for potentially misrepresenting the truth. But I think this serves as a really important reminder that no matter how seemingly easy, unproblematic it may appear, as much as we want to think of things as an easy fix, it's important to remember that all medications, all procedures, all surgeries can have potentially serious and even fatal side effects and adverse complications. Sometimes we as consumers dismiss them, particularly when these side effects are rare. In our desire to focus on the potential benefit, we dismiss the complication. Oh, it's rare. Oh, it's occurring in less than 1%. But at the end of the day, if you are the person that falls into that 1% category, if you are the one who gets that rare side effect, then you are the one that suffers. It is also important to note that a rare side effect may become more frequent as more people use the drug, the vaccine, the procedure, whatever the case may be. That percentage may be small, but again, of course, as more people are using the thing, the number affected increases. And this may be a cautionary tale, particularly right now with the popularity of the new class of weight loss drugs. These drugs, no doubt, are game changers. I am happy to have them. I am happy to prescribe them. But there are side effects and potential serious long-term adverse effects. And I wonder, as the use of these drugs increase, will we see more of these adverse effects come to light? Of course we will. Bottom line is that everything comes at a cost. And rather than be oblivious to that cause, rather than put our heads in the sand, hoping it won't be us, we won't be that 1%, we need to take them into account and weigh them into our decision-making with whatever we do. Next up, a ginormous study on alcohol shows that there is no positive effect on mortality as we once believed. And in fact, modest drinking increases the risk of death. Now, if you've been following with me recently, you may have noticed that we've been talking a lot about alcohol use, maybe because of my own awakening, maybe because we as doctors have touted the benefits of alcohol for so long, maybe because we were so wrong in doing so, and maybe because the public just does not know this data. Just recently, just this past weekend, I had friends and family over to celebrate my daughter's birthday, and a friend offered me a glass of wine and was surprised that I wouldn't drink it. Why? Isn't wine good for you? Yes, I know that this is what we have said because of antioxidants, because of resveratrol, because of the Mediterranean diet, but the data is clear that there are no benefits to drinking alcohol. And as a physician, I feel compelled to dispel this myth that alcohol, even wine, is good for you. So on March 31st, just a couple weeks ago, JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, published a massive review of 107 clinical studies that consisted of 4.8 million people that showed that no level of alcohol is beneficial and that alcohol use at any level trended towards greater mortality. So again, this was a massive number of people. Nearly 5 million people were looked at in this large study. And they showed that actually, not only was there no benefit, but again, there was a trend towards greater mortality in individuals who consumed alcohol on a regular basis. And this risk was most pronounced in women and became significant at 25 grams of ethanol, which is equivalent to roughly two or more standard drinks of alcohol per day, and became significant for men at 45 grams per day. So this is important data because it's showing us that unlike what we once believed, alcohol is not protective. It is not healthy for us. It does not result in longer life or less stability. And when consumed regularly, it will shorten your lifespan. What it also shows is that our prior recommendations of 1 to 2 drinks for women, 2 drinks for men per day is okay and considered healthy, again, is wrong. And our guidelines are behind the clinical data that shows that regular consumption of alcohol will shorten your lifespan. And you know, sometimes I feel like a preacher. I feel like a nun, and I really do not intend to be. I have no judgment here. I do not preach, but I do believe, as I said before, that we need to be informed, that we cannot stick our heads in the sand and ignore the data or the information that is available to us. So here is the information. Let it empower you. Now you get to choose what you want to do with it.
Hi, friends. It's Dr. Adrienne, and I'm dropping into your podcast to offer a love letter to you. I believe that our hunger represents our unmet emotional and spiritual needs. And by leaning in and listening to our hunger, we have an opportunity to hear our needs and to respond. I know this not only from personal experience, but from listening to the stories of hundreds, if not thousands of patients over the past almost 20 years. I have compiled these stories, including my own, into Hungry for More, Stories and Science to Inspire Weight Loss from the Inside Out. This book is not just about weight loss, but about life. and contains lessons that I know to be life-changing. If you don't believe me, head over to my website at dradrianudim.com, where you can obtain a free sample, or to amazon.com and check out the reviews for yourself.
And finally, last but not least, if you need to lose weight, Wegovy or Mounjaro. So in our last study in the news, late last week, pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly put in for a clinical trial with the National Governmental Database to compare their Mounjaro, a weight loss drug, to Novo Nordisk's Wegovy. So to get you up to speed here, Mounjaro is the name of the blockbuster drug that was approved last summer, again, for the treatment of type 2 diabetes. It follows a class of popular drugs like Ozempic, as it is a hormonal analog or copycat of a gut hormone that we normally release in response to food intake. Remember that Ozempic is the very same drug as Wegovy. The only difference is that Ozempic is packaged and named for diabetes, and that very same drug is packaged and named Wegovy when we are prescribing it for weight loss. It is the very same stuff inside of the injection. The difference between Ozempic and Wegovy and Mounjaro is that while Ozempic is a GLP-1 agonist, it delivers a copycat of one hormone, GLP-1, that is involved in satiety and glucose metabolism. Mounjaro is a dual agonist. It is a copycat of two drugs, not only GLP-1, but also another hormone called GIP. And so it delivers a copy of both GLP-1 and GIP, another gut hormone involved in satiety and glucose metabolism. Now, remember that Mounjaro is not yet approved for weight loss. It is only approved for diabetes. But they've already initiated the paperwork with the FDA in order to have it approved as a standalone weight loss drug in non-diabetics. Initial studies of Mounjaro show a whopping weight loss of 21% in non-diabetics as compared to the 12.4% weight loss that has been seen in clinical trials with Wegovy, which, let's be honest, is still pretty darn good. But no drug has ever given us the degree of weight loss we've seen with Mounjaro, which is comparable to what we used to see with gastric banding surgery, but without the surgery. So the potential for Mounjaro is quite promising. But we really don't know which one is best until we have the kind of head-to-head clinical trials that is being planned by Eli Lilly now. So stay tuned. There's and will be more information to come. But definitely, this is an interesting time for weight loss medications. And again, lots more to come. Stay here with me as I try to dissect it all with you through my lens of nearly 20 years of working with patients as a obesity medicine and physician nutrition specialist. That's all for this week, folks. So if you're ready to take the next bite of action, head over to my show notes right now and get my 5-step guide to health and well-being, which is filled with tips, steps, and motivation to nourish yourself, mind, and body. Thank you for being here with me today. Thank you for your time. Time is our most precious resource, and I so, so appreciate you spending some of that preciousness with me. I can't wait to see you back here again next week on Health Bite for a next episode. Until then, bye now.